Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 6, Episode 5 of the Emerging Leaders for Biodiversity, How Do I Do This?, an Environmental Careers Podcast. This week, we sit down with Samantha Stevens, an award-winning nature photographer and National Geographic explorer. She uses her photography and compelling storytelling to communicate scientific research and highlight the work of conservationists in Canada. Without further ado, let's get right to it.
All righty. Could you please state your name and your pronouns for us?
Yeah, my name is Samantha Stevens, and I use she, her pronouns.
Where are you calling in from today, Samantha?
I'm calling in from Ottawa, Ontario.
Awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about yourself for everyone listening? Who are you? What do you do? What's your job title? What's up?
I am a photographer, and I focus on telling stories about science and conservation. I do this work as a freelancer, so I don't work for any one entity, but I do belong to some professional organizations that support my work. I am an emerging league member of the International League of Conservation Photographers, as well as a National Geographic Explorer.
That's very cool.
That is crazy cool. What does that entail, National Geographic Explorer?
Yeah, National Geographic, they have the magazine, of course, that many people are familiar with, but they also have the National Geographic Society. And the society provides grant funding to professionals working in science and also in storytelling. And when you apply for a grant from the society and you're awarded a grant, you become a part of their explorer community. And that community provides a lot more learning opportunities and a hub for connecting with other explorers as well.
That is really cool. I did not know that about this.
Yeah, I definitely recommend if you're doing science research that you look into their granting program.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome program. So what does a typical day in your position look like?
There really is no typical day for me. I wear a lot of different hats, especially as a freelancer. First of all, here in Ontario, most of the wildlife science fieldwork is concentrated between April and September. During that time, I'm often out in the field with scientists photographing their work. When I'm not joining scientists in the field, I'm spending a lot of time at the computer. There's a lot that goes into this work aside from being out there making images. So before photographing a story, I do a ton of research and reading to understand the background of the science or conservation story that I'm working on. I spend a lot of time connecting with scientists to discuss their work, storyboarding, really thinking about the images I want to make and how I'm going to make them. Planning the logistics for fieldwork and working on any new technical photography skills that I'm going to need. On the back end, after I've returned from photographing, I'm cataloging images, writing captions, editing, making select, and pitching the story to different outlets for publication. It's pretty challenging to make a living just by publishing photos. So sometimes I work as a camera assistant on natural history documentaries, and I also teach photography and science communication workshops, both for photographers and for scientists. I also do a lot of public speaking at events or for university classes. And because I work as a freelancer, there's a lot of administrative work, such as creating invoices and budgets and a lot of grant writing as well to help fund the work that I do. I also do some communications work for the Algonquin Wildlife Research Station, which is where I've done a lot of my photography storytelling work as well. And finally, I occasionally take on some short-term contracts with organizations to advise on or work on science communication projects.
Wow, you weren't joking. That is a lot of different hats.
Yeah.
You touched on it a little bit already from the sounds of it, but how does your work differ from summer to winter?
Yeah, so typically in the summer, I'm out in the fields. And in the winter is when I'm doing the that sort of back end work for the photo storytelling and planning for the next summer.
Can you tell us a little bit about the education that kind of led you to your position freelancing as a photographer?
Yeah, it's a bit of a winding path for sure. I grew up in a city in Ottawa where I'm calling from now. And although nature and wildlife was never far from my front door, I didn't have a lot of experiences in the outdoors growing up. It just wasn't something our family did very often. And so instead, my first real introduction to wildlife and nature was on the pages of my science textbooks in middle school. I quickly became obsessed with all science subjects. And I guess because of this way that I became acquainted with wildlife through science, the two things were linked in my understanding of the world. And as a result, I thought the only way to continue to pursue that interest was academically as a scientist. So I followed the only career path that I thought there was, and I became a scientist. And for me, that meant going to university for a biology undergraduate degree. And then immediately after that, I began a master's of science degree in environmental and life sciences. And it was during this time that I was in grad school that was learning about all the fascinating work that my peers were doing and thinking more and more about science communication and how we communicate the work that scientists are doing to non-scientists. And at the same time, I was having some realizations about what the day-to-day reality of being a scientist really was. I don't think I had a very good understanding of that. Even when I was in my undergraduate degree in biology, I just liked learning about everything. And so doing my first research project as a master's student, I started to realize that science wasn't really about learning cool facts about animals and always being out in the fields, but there was a lot more to it, such as data analysis, which was something that didn't really fit very well with my skill set and my interests. And I was starting to see some really great examples of science communication. One really great example was a documentary called Chasing Ice. And in this documentary, a photographer goes out and sets up time-lapse cameras on glaciers and creates this visual of glaciers melting. And I thought that was really cool to use photography as a way to communicate science. And so I became interested in doing that myself. And I thought at that time, I thought it was too late for me. I had already gone so far down the path in my education as a scientist that I didn't really want to go back to school for photography or film. But luckily, I came across a program offered by Fleming College that takes place at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. It's a postgraduate program that is an intense, condensed program. It's about 7 months long, and it's called Environmental Visual Communication. And it is specifically built for people with a background in science who want to become visual storytellers. So we had classes in not just photography, but in film, in graphic design. We learned about blog writing and public speaking and coding websites and everything you might need to know if you worked in the communications department of an environmental organization. And then since graduating from that program, I gravitated much more towards photography, and I continued on my journey to become a photographer.
That's very cool. I have never heard of that program being offered at the ROM. That sounds like such a valuable program.
Yeah, I haven't either. I think between my bachelor's and master's, I had one basic science communication course between the two, and that sounds great.
Yeah. And at the time that I was becoming interested in this, I was in grad school. Let me think. It was 2016. when I was in the midst of my graduate school. And at that time, science communication, it wasn't really as big a field as it is today, especially conservation photography. When you Google conservation photography, really only two things came up. It was the International League of Conservation Photographers and this environmental visual photography program. Now the field has grown so much, and there's many more people doing this work, which is very encouraging.
Definitely. I see, too, a lot more jobs lately. Like when I'm perusing the job boards, they actually have science communication roles as part of like entry-level biologists and environmental roles. They want you to take on social media and website on top of being a field tech.
Yeah, it's great to see organizations recognizing the value of science communication.
For sure. You said that your career path was quite winding, which is pretty common in the environmental field. But did you have any downtime in between contracts where you weren't able to find work? And what advice do you have for someone that's between contracts right now, if you have any?
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of downtime, especially when I first started out. When I graduated from the Environmental Visual Communication Program, I decided that I was going to do this work in a freelance capacity, but it definitely takes time to build up momentum as a freelancer. And at the same time, I still needed to work on my photography skills. I picked up a camera for the first time when I started the EVC program, and it was only 7 months long. So I still had a lot of work to do to improve my skills. And so when I first started out, most of my income came from my job as a part-time server and bartender, especially in the first few years. This allowed me to make ends meet while I was pursuing the work that I wanted to do as a photographer. I was very lucky to have a boss who was supportive of my career goals and allowed me to disappear for a month to do a project and then come back and work at the restaurant. So finding a part-time job or even a seasonal job that you can pair with shorter-term contracts that you do in the field that you're trying to work in is a great way to try and manage financial stability. And it doesn't necessarily have to be related to the field that you're trying to work in. And now time between projects is so precious to me because that's the time that I get to regroup and work on things that often get pushed to the side when I'm really busy on projects, like revisiting my long-term goals and planning new projects and also working on new skills. I guess my other advice for anyone between contracts would be to look at that time as a way to continue to work on your skills. For example, for me, I took some time to get my drone license. You could work on getting your wilderness first aid certification, anything that you might not have time to do when you're working full time, but can help increase your skills. Now, of course, I recognize that time between contracts can also be difficult financially. So sometimes you're not able to afford to do those things. But if you can, it's a great way to spend that time.
Absolutely. That's funny. I went the bartending route too and used to do that each winter and then back in the field in the spring.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I have friends who work at ski resorts during the winter, which tends to be the off season for a lot of biology field work.
Definitely. All right. This one might be a tough one for you to narrow it down, but if you had to pick a single thing, what's the best part of your job?
Yeah, you're right. There's definitely a lot of aspects of my job that I really enjoy. The best part, if I had to choose something, I think would be that I get to experience many different wildlife research projects and always be learning something new, which is what drew me to being interested in science in the first place. One thing that I really struggled with as I got further down the path of becoming a scientist was choosing something to focus on in my career. So often scientists become very focused on a narrow field of study as they move forward in their career. And there was nothing that stood out to me as something that I wanted to focus on because I was really interested and curious about everything. Now, in my role as a storyteller, I get to do these really deep dives into different wildlife research projects, but I get to work on a broad spectrum of different projects at the same time. So I really get to indulge my curiosity.
That's awesome. I know that's one of the things that I bumped into in my career journey as well. It's so hard to narrow it down when you love a lot of aspects of the career that you're about to get into.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, on the flip side, there are awesome and great parts of your job, but there's always a not so great side of any career. If you had to pick one thing that is a little less glamorous or a little less fun to do, your least favorite part of your job, what would it be?
Yeah, I think probably the most difficult part of doing what I do is the lack of stability. And it's the lack of stability in work hours, the lack of stability in location, and probably most difficult is the lack of stability financially working as a freelancer. It can be really difficult to earn a living doing this type of work. And unfortunately, photography tends to be undervalued sometimes. There's a lot of people who ask you to do what you do for free. And there's so much high caliber skill that goes into this work, so much time and so much effort. And there's also a huge financial overhead when it comes to photography because you need to own all your photography gear. You need to ensure that you basically cover all your overhead expenses, like having a website and the software that you use to edit photos and videos. And so it can be really discouraging when people don't recognize the financial value of what you do.
Yeah, that's very fair. Definitely an expensive thing to get into and maintain for sure.
Yes.
I've heard too, I don't know if you've experienced this from other photographers, that there's issues too with copyright or people stealing your images. Have you run into that at all?
Yeah, that's always a challenge. There's some photographers who spend a lot more time chasing down people who use their images without permission or without compensation. There are a few times where that's happened to me, usually when I approach the person who is at fault or the organization that's at fault. Typically, they respond, maybe not positively, but at least neutrally to my explanation of why what they're doing isn't appropriate. I think sometimes people aren't informed about that, about how to use other people's artistic work in an appropriate way. So I try to help educate people, give them the benefit of the doubt.
You mentioned growing up in Ottawa, being close to nature, but were there any memberships or experiences that really gave you that first spark of interest or made you really want to get out there?
Nothing really comes to mind jumping out as being influential as I was growing up. Yeah, that there wasn't really anything that was part of my journey in my early years that really gave me a love of nature. It was really, I think I found that in academia. And I wish that I had maybe found this interest earlier. But regardless, I got to where I am today, so I wouldn't change anything.
And if you could go back in time and give yourself any advice, what would it be?
I would probably give myself a lot of advice. Career that I've ended up in, it's not one that has a defined path. Everyone who works in this field has a different educational background, different lived experience, different ways that they combine different income streams to make it work, and different ways that they approach their practice. And pursuing this career has been a huge learning experience. And I continue to learn I think most of us in this field will be students for the entirety of our career. And I think that probably applies to most careers. But if I were to give myself one piece of advice, I think I'd probably just tell myself to not be so hard on myself and give myself the grace to learn by doing, learn by what is successful, and also learn by the things that don't go as planned.
That's awesome advice. And I think that's similar to what a lot of people in these meandering careers give to themselves. It can be tricky to be gentle with yourself when you're hopping around and lacking stability.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think a lot of people who work in science and work in photography are very ambitious because they're so passionate about what they do, that they really take what they do seriously and they really want to have an impact with their work. So that can be a lot of pressure to put on ourselves.
100%. I can remember even in my undergrad, like if I don't have X thing done by X time, it's all over and escape over. There's no future, and putting on a lot of that stress. And then looking back, I'm like, oh, that was dumb. I didn't have to do that.
Yeah. And working as a photographer to tell other people's stories, you feel a lot of pressure to do the best job that you can because you want to honor those people. And I take the responsibility of sharing those stories very seriously. When you think something hasn't gone the way that you expected, it can be discouraging.
Absolutely.
So that is all of the typical questions. And then we just have a rapid fire question session where we just throw some questions at you.
It's great.
I bet being a photographer, you found some pretty cool and wild things out in the field. Do you have a strangest or wildest thing that you've ever found out in the field?
There have been many strange things. It's hard to think of one. Maybe it's because I don't find things strange anymore. Yeah, I think I've joined on so many different research projects, and I think that there's definitely strange and interesting ways or unexpected ways that scientists, the methods that they use to do their study. I guess one example, I joined a scientist working on wolf research. And I think joining for that fieldwork was some of the strangest fieldwork that I've done. One thing in particular was taking wolf scat samples and putting them in women's nylons and boiling the scat in these women's stockings in order to, there's a parasite that exists in wolf scat. So that's part of the reason is to neutralize that parasite so it's safe to work with. But also the scientist was looking at wolf diets. So we're trying to get rid of the fecal matter and look at the hair and bones that existed in the scat. Boiling a big pot of wolf scat in ladies' stockings was probably one of the weirdest things that I photographed.
That's fair. That is pretty weird.
Yeah. I can't imagine what that room smelled like.
Oh, it was not good. And I definitely had that smell stuck in my nostrils for quite some time. Yeah, it's a pretty distinct smell. And I did feel a little bit nauseous at points throughout doing that work. And joining that same scientist was when I did some work from a helicopter as well. And I get very motion sick just driving 2 minutes in a car if I'm not even driving. So I was prepared with my gravel, with a barf bag, with whatever I could be prepared with. And we were flying for full days, like 8-hour days, trying to find wolves. And I had the door of the helicopter open and I was looking sideways out the door, which anyone who gets motion sick knows is the first rule of avoiding motion sickness is to not look out the window, especially the side window. And then I, on top of that, was also looking through the viewfinder of my camera. And yeah, I was very nauseous. It took me, I think, a couple of weeks to feel normal again after that. But I do it again. It was a lot of fun, and we made some great images.
That sounds like quite the experience. And you're very strong-willed for making it through that, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a blast. Did you guys find many wolves?
You know what? Yeah, I did just say it was for finding wolves, but I was mistaken. I was joining the scientist that I typically document his wolf research, but we were actually doing surveys, beaver population surveys. So it was in the fall after the leaves have fallen off the trees. So you have a pretty good aerial view. And he was counting feed piles that beavers prepare for the winter. They stack fresh branches in front of their lodges so they have access to food over the winter. And you can do beaver population surveys in this way because you can look for the number of active feed piles and get an estimate of population numbers off of that.
That's very cool research too. I've always thought it really cute to see beavers make these little snack piles so that they can survive the winter. I love seeing those.
Yeah, I can definitely take inspiration from that for my own lifestyle.
Yeah, me too.
I'm imagining you both just have snack stashes stored.
That's a very important thing to have when you're doing field work. You don't want to be hungry when you're out in the field. So I definitely make sure I have all the snacks when I'm doing field work.
What is your favorite field snack?
That's a great question. Okay, my favorite not healthy field snack that's a treat for morale when you're doing field work. Sometimes snacks can be good for a morale boost, but I'm definitely a peanut M&M. I have an addiction to peanut M&M, so I always make sure I have peanut M&M when I'm in the field. But then I also make sure I have some snacks, like cheese is great because it's really filling, gives you some protein. Yeah, cheese, crackers, nuts, seeds, that kind of thing is good for actually keeping your energy levels and your stomach full.
Those are all great snacks.
Yeah.
You have a favorite nature moment, whereas maybe like just you in the woods and locked eyes with an animal or something like that?
Yeah. Every time you go out into nature, you see something interesting. And it's a cliche that a lot of people say, but it's a cliche because it's true. I think for me, it wasn't necessarily a moment, but the first season that I spent at the Algonquin Wildlife Research Station, that was really fascinating for me because I was there from April until October. And for the first time, I was in a place for an extended period of time, being outside every day, where I really got to see the change in seasons and the change in wildlife activity from the spring to the fall. You go through different phases, and in science, they call it phenology. But in the spring, you notice the flowers start to bloom, and then the black flies come out. And then once the black flies start dying down, the mosquitoes come out. And once the mosquitoes die down, the deer flies come out. So you see these phases in phenology. And I guess I use biting insects as an example because that's the thing that you really notice in Algonquin Park. But there's a lot of other phenology that I got to witness by spending spring to fall at the station.
Yeah, the bugs there are next level. I remember doing field work at night there and looking at my gloved hand, and I had, I think, 40 mosquitoes just on one hand trying to hold up a net.
Yeah, it's definitely a struggle. It's unfortunate that the timing of black fly and mosquito season is the timing of a lot of wildlife activity. And so that's generally when field biologists are out in the field. But you mentioned your gloved hands, and that's probably my biggest tip if you are doing field work or if you're doing photography during that time, is that nitrile gloves that scientists mostly use in a lab setting, the biting insects can't actually bite through those. Often I wear those gloves, not because I'm trying to avoid contamination, but because I'm protecting my hands from the biting insects, especially when you're doing video or photography, you're trying to hold your camera still. And if biting insects are attacking your hands, that can be quite difficult.
Definitely. You probably can't get away with a mosquito net either, because it would inhibit your vision. So you're probably just roughing it.
That is also a struggle. Yeah, I do have one of those bug jackets, which is very useful, and I definitely wear it. And I try to wear it as much as possible, but it does really inhibit your ability to look through the viewfinder. Sometimes I have to unzip that face shield and just bear the brunt of the biting insect.
Yeah, it's definitely a struggle. Biting insects everywhere, but Algonquin Park is a special place for that.
Yeah.
So I guess in your free time, when you're not in the field taking photos, what do you like to fill your time with?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in nature without my camera. And I think for me, that's really important because I find that nature, spending time in nature is something that really helps me unwind. It helps clear my mind. It is something that I enjoy. And so I want to make sure that spending time in nature doesn't become synonymous with work. So I make sure that I spend a lot of time in nature without my camera, which can be hard to do because, as all photographers know, when you're out in nature without your camera, that's when you see the most photogenic moments.
I was about to say there must be those times where you're like, son of a bitch, no camera on hand.
Yeah, you always joke if you're going out with a group and I say, oh, I'm going to leave my camera behind because that way we'll see a wolf. Because it really does. It's really those moments sometimes when you're not prepared that some spectacular things unfold. But it's important, I think, as photographers that we experience the world, not just through our viewfinders, and we are able to be in the moment as just people and not as photographers.
Absolutely. What is an example of positive change you're hoping to create with your photography and with your work?
That's a great question. I only picked up a camera in the first place because I really believed in its power as a tool to communicate science and to create action for conservation. And I don't have to convince this audience that we are in some very scary times for our planet with the climate crisis and the continued destruction of the home that we share with the species on this planet. There's a great need to communicate the reality of our situation that we've created to non-scientists, and also a timely and limited opportunity to engage people in the solutions and come together to hopefully build a better future for ourselves and our planet. And photography is a very powerful communication tool because it allows us to bear witness to what is happening. It's independent of language. And the saying, a photograph is worth a thousand words, another cliche, but again, because it's true, we can communicate a lot in one image. And today, social media platforms are where a lot of people go for their news, and those platforms really put visuals at the forefront. Strong image is often what makes people stop to learn more. But beyond photography and single images, photography is most impactful when we can use it to tell stories. Stories help connect us with a character, so we can put ourselves in their shoes and understand their perspective and their challenges and why they choose to behave the way that they do. And that helps us build empathy and foster understanding for people that may be different than we are. And also to humanize science. So to really understand what it is that scientists do and what motivates them. And yeah, My ultimate goal is to use photography to tell stories that help foster understanding, that help non-scientists understand the value of scientific research, and that hopefully can change people's hearts and minds and ultimately actions when it comes to conservation issues.
That's awesome and very important work for sure.
Yeah, that was a great answer.
So finally, if someone wanted to get involved or see some of your work or learn more about what you do, where could they go to find out?
Yeah, that's a definitely an important question. To follow my work, I have a website. It's my last name and then my first name. So stevensamantha.com. And I put my work there. It's under construction right now, so there's not as much on there as there will be in the hopefully very near future. And I have an Instagram account. That's really the only social media platform that I really have a presence on professionally. And so my handle there is my name, Samantha Stevens, with an underscore at the end. And you might notice that I've been a little bit quiet when it comes to posts. That's because a lot of what I've been working on is not quite ready to be shared yet, but hopefully will be there soon. But I share a lot of what I'm doing on a daily basis, whether it's behind the scenes in the field, whether it's events that I'll be at or workshops that I'm giving in my Instagram stories. So that's a great way to follow what I'm doing. And in terms of this field more broadly, if what I've shared sounds interesting to you and you're curious about this career path, then you can check out the International League of Conservation Photographers. And they have a lot of great resources about this career. And you can find a lot of other professionals who are doing this work. And you can look at what their career paths have been, because like I said, everyone has a very different path. And if you are interested in photography, there's some other great organizations that you can get involved with to pursue that interest. So you can check out the North American Nature Photography Association, and they actually have a college scholarship program where if you are in a university program or a college program and interested in nature photography, you can attend their summit and do an intensive 1 week workshop. And you don't have to be a photographer in order to go and do that. I recommend checking that out if you're interested.
That's awesome advice. Thank you so much for that. I just personally checked out your Instagram and your website, and I was very excited to see, it's sad, but these photos are so cool of the salamanders inside of the pitcher plants.
Yeah, and that is normally the reaction that people have is that, wow, what a fascinating phenomenon. But yes, the juvenile salamanders are being eaten by the plant. That's life. Yeah, those images have really captivated people just because of the visual itself. Sometimes people say that the salamanders look like aliens being beamed up to a spaceship, or it looks like a reptile's eye. And so that work is a good example of what I try to do with my science photography, which is to show things in a way that makes people stop and learn more about what they're looking at.
Yeah, for sure. It looks like you do an amazing job of that. Great job.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Aranya gave me that list. I had been following your page and I follow a lot of photographers for a while. So when I saw your name on that list, it was no way. And you were one of the first people I emailed and messaged.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you. That means a lot. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of photographers out there doing this work who just have phenomenal images of science or wildlife. So yeah, if anyone's interested, then they can definitely reach out and I can give you a whole list of names of photographers who are doing phenomenal work.
Thank you so much. And I've learned a lot from this interview. Thank you for your time and thank you for answering all of our fun questions.
Yeah, it was great speaking to you this morning.
Yeah, no problem. I definitely get excited about sharing this career option with people who are in the environmental field because, like myself, a lot of people don't know that it's an option. So I wish I had learned about it earlier. So I definitely like any opportunity to share that with anyone else who's trying to figure out their career path. Thank you so much again for inviting me to do this. I really enjoyed it. And it was great to connect with both of you.
Thanks everyone for tuning in to Emerging Leaders for Biodiversity, How Do I Do This, an environmental career podcast.
Be sure to follow us on social media and our website using the handle EL4Biodiversity to get the latest news on upcoming events and other exciting opportunities.